Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Around the world, we are experiencing threats to democratic governments. Russia's attack on Ukraine and its fledgling democracy is among the most egregious, but here at home, we are experiencing a different kind of attack. The most visible example was the January 6th riot at the Capitol and the attempt of a horde of insurrectionists to stop the Electoral College count, reversing the outcome of a legitimate election and preventing the peaceful transfer of power, an American tradition. They failed, but details are now emerging that may indicate this was more than a spontaneous event. Since that day, there have also been moves in several states to weaken voting rights and to set up mechanisms that can be used to seize control of elections when certain parties are unhappy with the outcome. It is a slow, insidious creep from democracy to autocracy, and one that requires us to sit up, take notice, and possibly take action. But there may be a way out of this. Yasha Monk is a professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University and a contributing editor to The Atlantic. He's been watching with a keen eye these moves away from governments of the people, by the people, and for the people, and he may have some solutions. He's put it all in his book, The Great Experiment: Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. And he joins us for the hour. Good morning and welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
This is not the first book that you have written about this topic or to exploring this topic. You wrote The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. And you've traced the crisis democracy is experiencing for a while. Why and how did this catch your attention?
So I'm a political scientist by training. And when I was in grad school, I was taught by my professors that there's many democracies in the world that are at risk, countries that are relatively poor, countries that haven't had democratic governments for very long. But in countries like the United States, or in countries like Germany, where I grew up, you really no longer have to worry about democracy. Because those countries are pretty affluent, because they have such a long democratic tradition, because they've had at least two changes of government through free and fair election, we can fast forward history by 25 or 50 or 100 years, and we know there's always going to be a democracy. And part of the reason for that was supposed to be that everybody, in phrase of one article in the literature, accepts the rules of a democratic game, that democracy is the only game in town, that everyone might have deep political disagreements, but we all agree about elections and all those kinds of things. I started to see that a lot of parties and candidates were starting to rise in a number of different countries I follow, which seemed to question some of those basic rules, which didn't want to be bound by the outcome of elections, which started to cast doubt on whether we should trust them, which wanted to concentrate power in their own hands if they won, which were so hostile to the media that there's real questions about whether they would let it operate freely if they were in power. And so with a colleague, Roberto Four, we started to look at some opinion polls, which actually existed, that had been done long before. It's just nobody asked, looked sort of closely at those questions about whether people give importance to living in a democracy, whether they're open to autocratic alternatives to democracy. And looking at all of those pieces of evidence, we thought, hang on a second, not everybody accepts the rules of a democratic game anymore. People give a lot less importance to living in a democracy than they did in the past. They're more open to autocratic alternatives. So perhaps there's more to worry about than people tend to think.
Why this shift? Why are people more open to autocracy?
So that's the million-dollar question, and there's all kinds of reasons for that. I think one reason is that the most terrifying autocratic regimes are a little bit more distant from us now than they were a few decades ago, that we no longer have as vivid a memory of the Nazis, of the terrors of fascism, that also the horrors of the Soviet Union feel, a good number of decades ago in history. And so I think it's harder for us to imagine what it means to lose a democracy. So that's one reason. But I think there's also structural drivers of discontent with our governments. We have a stagnation of living standards for average citizens. So in the United States, for example, from 1935 to 1960, the living standard of an average American doubled. From 1960 to 1985, it doubled again. But since 1985, it has more or less been mostly stagnant. So that really changes how people think about politics.
And you mentioned, you started talking about Germany and how they have accepted, it's a foregone conclusion that democratic form of government is what they want and what they engage in. And you talked about this being in more trouble in less economically successful countries. And yet I can't think of a single example, maybe Saudi Arabia, of an autocratic regime in which it's gotten better for citizens, as opposed to a democratic regime where things do get better for citizens?
I think there's two different questions here, right? One is that it's true on the aggregate that being an autocracy does not help economic development. But there are a couple of very salient examples where people think that it has gotten better, right? So undoubtedly, China is vastly more affluent now than it was two or three decades ago. You can point to examples like Singapore, which is a sort of semi-autocratic regime and is quite economically successful. And so people tend to look at those to claim that autocracy actually advances economic growth. That's not true on average. I think that there are better and worse performing autocracies. On average, autocracies don't do better than democracies. But people don't tend to look abroad, actually. They just tend to look at their own country. So I think the feeling is just that 30, 40 years ago, people might have said, I don't like those people in DC, I don't trust politicians. But you know what? In the end, things seem to be working. My life's pretty good. I'm pretty optimistic about the future. Let them do their thing. And now I think people tend to say, hey, I'm doing worse than my parents. My kids are going to do much worse than me. Let's try something new. What do we have to lose? And those examples of all the many autocracies that have terrible economic stagnation, those are countries that are not so well known in the United States that are far away, and people don't tend to think of those.
But let's talk for just a second about China, because you're right. In China, they have raised the economic standards of the population. They're buying designer fashions and expensive cars and things like, not everybody, but a lot of people are. And there are lots of billionaires and millionaires in China as a result of all of this. But in this country, for instance, during the pandemic, we almost went to war with each other over masks. In Beijing, they are locking people in their apartments because they're experiencing a resurgence of COVID over there. There's a trade-off here when you switch from democracy to autocracy. You can do all kinds of things under an autocratic regime that you can't do under a democratic regime. Are people willing to make that trade-off?
Well, no, I don't think they are. In that sense, look, I was one of the first to say that we should respond robustly to the pandemic. I wrote an article in The Atlantic called Cancel Everything in March of 2020, which went viral. So I certainly took the pandemic seriously. Unlike some of my friends, I actually was also a little bit heartened by the people who said, I don't want to wear a mask. Not because I thought they were necessarily rational or I agreed with them, but I actually think that this instinct to say, I'm not going to let the government tell me what I should do, can be healthy, even if in a particular case it's misguided. And there I think it's important to look closely at whether autocratic systems actually work better. So I came across a study out of Stanford University a couple of weeks ago, and all the stuff Stanford University with press releases and social media accounts was really pushing this study, saying, the cost of free speech was supposedly many more Americans dying. And the claim in the article was that because you can have conspiracy theories and false information about vaccines, questioning their effectiveness and pretending that they're much more dangerous than they are, that information led to a certain number of Americans not getting vaccinated and dying as a result. The problem with this study and with framing it as the cost of free speech is that in social science, you always want to think about what we call the counterfactual. Right, you have to say, if you think that free speech caused this bad outcome, you have to actually look at what the world would look like without free speech. And I think the study was very naive in thinking through that, because a world without free speech is not a world in which we have highly effective vaccines and everybody trusts them. It's a world in which science doesn't get made in the rapid way it has been here, which helps to explain why America has much more effective vaccines than China does. Mm. And by the way, free speech means that people are much more likely, on the whole, to trust the system, because they know that when people have criticisms of it, they can voice them. And we know that too, because it turns out that in China, uptake of a local vaccine is really, really low, especially among older people. So actually, this very autocratic system, which has good control of its flow of information, has not been better at getting its own citizens to take vaccines than we have in the United States. And so I think we should be absolutely more aware of the strengths of our system, including the importance of free speech.
I was listening to a discussion recently on one of those television news shows about civics and how we have not effectively taught civics in this country for a very long time, which is why, in many cases, they say, we had this insurrection at the Capitol, because people don't understand how the government works. They don't understand what the electoral college functions, etc., and why we have some members of Congress who are anti-government and don't understand our system of government. You were born in Germany of Polish parents, and in an article in the New York Times, you wrote about your experience taking the oath of allegiance to this country. And you say that while taking that oath, you, quote, choked up and found it difficult to get the words out. But when then your voice took on a new resolve, proud and determined. I swore, you said, to defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. For all the worry that Americans profess to have about immigrants and assimilation into our culture and how they might potentially change it, it seems to me that immigrants may know more about our government and our laws than natural-born citizens, because we don't have to take a test. We don't have to study that stuff. Do you think that folks who come from other countries here have a better understanding and a better appreciation for what American democracy is all about?
Yeah, I don't know whether on average they do or don't know more things about our political system. Certainly, if they want to become citizens, have to study these 100 questions, and those are, you know, a pretty decent basis of understanding at least some of the fundamentals. What we do know from surveys is that immigrants are actually extremely patriotic, and that young immigrants, for example, are more likely than young native-born Americans to say that they admire American political institutions, that they're proud to be American, and a number of other points. So I do think that immigrants tend to be very patriotic. And certainly I think that anybody who's lived in an autocratic system, as many, but of course not all immigrants will have done, understands in a visceral way what it means not to have the things that we can often take for granted in the United States, you know, like free speech, like free assembly, like the freedom to worship as we please, than people who've always been lucky enough to live in a free country. And so I do think that, you know, immigrants have a lot of wisdom to offer there.
Yasha Monk is our guest. He's a professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. And when we come back, we'll talk about the drift in this country away from democracy by some and toward autocracy, and when that might have begun. It didn't begin on January 6th. It began well before that. We'll talk about that and more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Yasha Monk, professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University, author of The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. January 6th was a frightening day in America and a surprising one for many people who have seen major differences develop between Democrats and Republicans, but we've never seen a fight to keep an illegitimate government in office because Donald Trump lost that election. He did not win it, and there were attempts to try to stop the Electoral College count in the hopes that he would stay in the White House. But it didn't begin on January 6th. And you referred earlier in our conversation to surveys that if we had just read them and noticed them, we would have noticed that people were open to a different form of government. When did this all begin in this country? Do you know?
Well, for me, the way that I think about it is a crop of politicians who I call populists. Now, that term can be confusing and misleading because it refers to so many different kinds of things. And sometimes people think, well, popularist, isn't it good to want to be popular? And that, of course, is perfectly fine in a democracy. But what I talk about when I talk about a populist is somebody who says that they and they alone truly represent the people, and that somebody who disagrees with them is by nature of that fact illegitimate. I think one very elegant encapsulation of that political attitude comes from the Twitter handle of Evo Morales, the Bolivian leader, which is Evo es pueblo, Evo is the people, which implies that anybody who disagrees with him is outside of the people, is a traitor, is an enemy. And of course, a person who came to power in the United States with that kind of rhetoric and continued to engage it while in office was Donald Trump, who distinguished from the beginning between real Americans and those that aren't real Americans, who talked about traitors, who wanted to lock up his political opponents. And so it didn't surprise me that whenever any kind of limit on his power presented itself during his time in office, he tried to undermine those independent power centers. And when it turned out that he lost his bid for re-election, he fought, probably to some extent genuinely, that this is an impossibility. If you represent the people, if you are the people, how can the people possibly be against you?
Well, but isn't that delusional? Some sabotage. He was elected to office by a tiny, narrow margin through the Electoral College. Isn't it delusional to think that you are the people, given that you didn't come into office in the first place with a great majority and you lost the second election?
I mean, look, I think people are the heroes in their own stories and they like to perceive reality as it flatters them. There's a whole narrative about the fact there's all of these enemies, people on public radio and other places that, won't recognize his greatness and which are misleading people. Some poor innocents are being misled, but, he is the representative of the people. And in the end, that's always got to show itself in election results. I do think that that's how these populists tend to think. And we see that not just in the United States with Trump, but with many other people around the world, people like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Recep Erdogan in Turkey, people like Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, people like Evo Morales in Bolivia, many leaders around the world.
But we used to see those people as evil, as crazy, as deluded, and now here it's happening here. And I'm wondering if there's a natural progression to this. For years after World War II, people generally looked favorably upon the government, and the government could get a lot of things done. They built the interstate highway system, we sent men to the moon, etc. Then these anti-system, anti-government candidates began to emerge. Ronald Reagan said that government is the problem. Grover Norquist, the anti-tax Republican, said that he would like to shrink government to the size of a teacup so that it would fit into a teacup. And then you have the Tea Partiers who appear on the scene to move even more into an anti-government direction. But now, they seem to be, not they, but people seem to be moving toward an anti or even un-American point of view. Is that the natural progression of all of this?
No, I don't agree that those two things necessarily fall in the same category. I think, one way of distinguishing between this is whether you're anti-elitist or anti-pluralist. So many politicians are anti-elitist. Barack Obama was anti-elitist in his 2008 campaign. He was saying all these people in Washington, Washington is broken, and all these people over there, they have a problem. We need somebody really new and fresh, as Obama then was, to come in and sort of clean up and change how things are done. That is a normal part of democratic politics. The debate over the size of a state is also a normal part of political contestation. I personally favor a generous welfare state. I think that the state does have an obligation to ensure that its citizens are protected against the big misfortunes of life. But I think it's perfectly legitimate for people to disagree with me and to say, no, you know, government should be less big and people should have more personal responsibility, and that's more important. I don't necessarily agree with that political program, but I think that's perfectly legitimate. That's different from saying the basic rules of a game are rigged. That's different from saying, when you're an elected president as a representative of the people, there should be no constraint on what you can do. It's those claims which undermine the separation of powers and the Constitution in a much more radical way.
This attraction toward autocracy and away from democracy, it's a relatively recent phenomenon, certainly here. But there are some reasons, I would think, for it. And you write about the influence of globalization in all of this. You point out that it was only within the past 40 or 50 years that democracies began to embrace outsiders, people coming into their countries from other countries, because humans like to sort themselves into groups. Talk about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I was starting to talk earlier about what some of the reasons for the rise of populists like Trump is. And one of them is the stagnation of living standards for ordinary citizens. Another we haven't talked about that much is the internet and social media. But there's a third one, which is really important, which really is at the heart of my new book, of A Great Experiment. And that is the transformation of many ethnically and religiously relatively homogeneous democracies into much more multi-ethnic diverse ones, or as is the case in the United States and a few other democracies that always have been relatively diverse, the inclusion of people who used to be excluded, often in the most extreme ways, into the political system as hopefully full equals. And so what's without precedent is the attempt we're now making in the United States and so many other democracies around the world to sustain these really ethnically and religiously diverse democracies while treating everybody as an equal. And what I argue in the book is that that is actually a really hard thing to do. There are deep reasons rooted in human psychology and in human history that make this much more difficult than people tend to realize. But it's by recognizing those difficulties that we can end up having a more optimistic assessment of our current reality and a little bit more hope for building societies that make this work and that thrive.
When the homogeneous group of people who have traditionally controlled a country, not just this one, suddenly finds all these newcomers coming in and taking power, running for office, doing things that they used to have exclusive control over, that brings up a natural fear of a loss of control. And I'm wondering, I heard somebody say the other day that in this country, the white power structure, those who are most fear this in the white power structure, see this as a zero-sum game, that if they give up power to anybody, then they lose. Is that true?
No. There is something about democracies which make it tempting to think that. So one of the points I make in the book is that it's really hard to build diverse democracies because we have this deeply ingrained instinct to form groups and to discriminate in favor of the members and against those who don't belong. And even people who think of themselves as very tolerant and enlightened can easily fall for that. So I have a very diverse set of students who think of themselves as the most tolerant people who've ever lived, and in some ways they are. But when I have them debate whether or not a hot dog is a sandwich and have them play a game against each other afterwards, the people who said that a hot dog is a sandwich are going to start discriminating against the people who said that a hot dog is not a sandwich. So this instinct to form in groups goes really deep. That's one challenge. The second challenge is that we see in human history that not all, but many of the worst crimes that we've committed as a species have to do with wars and civil wars and ethnic cleansings and genocides, which were carried out along those ethnic and religious fault lines of one group battling another because of their perceived differences. And then the third point is that you might think that democratic institutions solve all of this, that as long as we vote and we agree to abide by the outcome of the election in terms of who gets to rule, that should put all of those conflicts aside. But reality turns out to be more complicated than that, because actually, you know, in a monarchy or in an empire, you don't have any voice and I don't have any voice. And we both have to trust the monarch. So if you have more kids, so there's more people coming into the country who look like you rather than me, it doesn't affect my political standing. But in a democracy, of course, there's always a search for an electoral majority. And if I used to be in the majority group and that gave me certain privileges, or gave me certain advantages, and suddenly you have more kids, or there's more people coming in who belong to your group, I might worry that, hang on a second, I'm going to lose my majority. And suddenly you'll rule and everything will change. And so that is a mechanism you see in many democracies. But in the United States today, it's exacerbated by the fact that, Republicans and Democrats, actually, conservatives and liberals, have come to agree what I regard as a myth, which is this idea that demography is destiny, and that we can fast forward American politics by a few decades and know exactly what will happen because of the demographic shifts we're going through.
And you reject that idea that democracy, that demography is destiny. But if one group of people is having more children than another, they are going to grow in numbers, and the makeup of your country is going to change. So why isn't it destiny?
Yeah, so there's two ideas here. The first is the projection of the United States Census Bureaus and other demographers that America is supposedly becoming what we call majority-minority by 2045, or perhaps 2042, or perhaps 2048. The exact year tends to vary according to projections, but you know, within about 2.5 decades. And the second is the political observation that white voters tend to favor the Republican Party and non-white voters tend to favor the Democratic Party. And so as the white share of the population declines, it looks like Republicans are gonna dwindle and Democrats are gonna become stronger and stronger, and so therefore we can assume that you know, Democrats will win all these elections.
Now, you're saying that's an incorrect assumption, correct?
That is incorrect, yes. Look, here's one way of thinking about it. When you look at the politics of the 1960s, you would conclude that Irish Americans are the most important voter bank for Democrats, right? Support JFK in huge numbers, traditionally Democratic electorate. Well, it turns out today that Irish Americans tend to vote very reliably for the Republican Party. So where a group votes on within the party system can really shift over time. Mm-hmm. When you look at the 2020 election, this is a point that I think often is underemphasized. The only real reason why Donald Trump was competitive in that election is that he significantly boosted his share of the vote among every non-white voter group, among African-Americans, among Asian-Americans, and especially among Latinos. And the only reason, or the main reason, why Joe Biden ended up being the legitimately elected 46th president of the United States is that he actually significantly increased his share of the white vote relative to Hillary Clinton in 2016. So what we've actually seen in the last years is a racial depolarization of the electorate. And there's no reason to think that, depending on the choice of politicians and so on, that shouldn't continue to take place in the coming decades.
So why would, in states controlled by Republicans, we are watching what appears to be an effort to minimize the voting effectiveness of certain non-white voting groups, because they are presumed to vote to favor Democrats over Republicans, and this is a matter of survival in many minds of GOPers. Why not take the opposite tact? Why not embrace, why not become the bigger tent party and embrace these people and increase your numbers and win that way?
Well, this is exactly why I call this assumption that democracy is destiny the most dangerous idea in American politics, because it leads Republicans to this form of demographic panic in which they think that they won't be able to win in future because of these demographic changes. Michael Anton, who went on to be a senior advisor in Trump White House, wrote a very influential essay during the fall of 2016, talking about, I quote, the ceaseless importation of third world foreigners, end quote, and the way in which it was supposedly going to destroy both the American Republic and the Republican Party. So it is precisely this kind of doom mongering about demographic change, which drives a lot of the worst, most anti-democratic measures in the Republican Party. I think it's also a problem for the Democratic Party, because Democrats often end up thinking, you know, all we need to do is to mobilize our base, which they misunderstand. They think that the base is consistently very liberal and that especially non-white voters are very progressive, which is actually untrue. Whites within the Democratic Party are much more progressive, much more likely to be very liberal than non-white voters within the Democratic Party. And so Democrats often make deep electoral miscalculations because they think the future will just fall into their lap. But I actually want to go one step further than this, because this is not just about politics. It's actually about how we think about the fundamental dividing lines in our society. I don't just think that it's a mistake to assume Democrats are easily going to win elections in 10 or 20 years because of demographic shifts. I think it's actually a mistake to think that America is ever going to be majority-minority in a meaningful sense. The Census Bureau applies the one-drop rule, not just to African-Americans, but to every demographic group in the United States. It thinks that anybody who has, quote-unquote, one drop of Asian-American or Latino or African-American blood, and anybody who has some kind of cultural connection to a Spanish or Portuguese-speaking country, forms this monolithic group of people of color, and that the fundamental division in American life runs between a homogeneous group of white people and a homogeneous group of people of color. I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the country looks like today and how most people conceive of themselves. You have a lot of mixed race Americans who have a much more complicated identity, some of whom think of themselves as people of color, many of whom don't. You have Asian Americans who whose position in the racial sort of order in the United States is very complicated. And you have Latinos, a lot of whom actually think of themselves as white rather than people of color.
Yascha Mounk, our guest, will continue talking about the great experiment called democracy in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Yascha Mounk, professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University, a contributing editor to The Atlantic and the author of The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. I want to follow up on this, the idea that homogeneity is slipping away in this country and other societies around the world. You call the efforts to build on a vision of a more just and diverse democracy the new great experiment. Are we attempting that in this country, or are we fighting it?
I think we are attempting it, actually. You know, we are in this unprecedented situation of trying to treat each other equally in this very deeply ethnically and religiously diverse democracy. And I've noticed something interesting about all of this, which is that often people start with a kind of naivety or optimism about this project, and that pushes them into a pessimism and a fatalism. So what a lot of my friends and colleagues think is that it should be really easy to build these diverse democracies. You know, how hard is it to get along? How hard is it not to be mad at your neighbor because they're somehow different from you? And then you look at the reality in the United States and you recognize real problems and injustices which pervade our society today. And you say, oh my God, you know, if we're failing at this easy task, we must be terrible and there's no hope for the future. I think actually the right way of thinking about it is the other way around, which is that building these diverse democracies is incredibly difficult. It is incredibly hard. We've seen it go wrong in ways that I describe in the book and in many times and places, often horrifically. And we have a difficult past ourselves as a country, of course. And there's human psychological historical mechanisms for why it is so difficult to get along among these different groups. And if you start take that as a starting point, you realize how difficult what we're doing actually is. Then I think you can look at reality today and say, despite the problems, we've made real progress. Let me give you one example. Within the United States, about 30 years ago, the majority of Americans thought that it was immoral to have interracial marriage. It was immoral for a white and a black person to marry, to have children together. That is now down to the single digits. Still too many, but way, 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 way fewer Americans think that than they did 30 years ago. And we know that that's a real change in behavior, because we used to have about 1 in 33 newborns in the United States be mixed race. And now it's about 1 in 7 or 1 in 6. So there's a really rapid transformation in how we're living and the extent to which we're intertwining our lives across different groups. We see the same for immigration, by the way. There's this odd pessimism, which is shared by many people on the right, but also people on the left, where people on the far right are going to say, you know, Italian and Irish immigrants 100 years ago succeeded because they came from the right kind of culture, in quotation marks, or the right kind of people, in quotation marks, or people coming in today from El Salvador and Vietnam and Kenya, they're never going to succeed because there's supposedly something wrong with them. Now, you know, people in the mainstream and on the left reject that attribution of blame, rightly so, but they often echo that pessimism because they end up saying, Irish and Italian immigrants 100 years ago could succeed because they were white, and the immigrants today don't stand a chance because our society is so discriminatory and so racist that they simply can't integrate, that they can't be successful. Now, there is discrimination and injustice, and we have to take it seriously. We have to fight against it. But the best studies indicate that that is just too pessimistic a view of what is going on, because in fact, we're seeing that people are acquiring the language rapidly, that the children and grandchildren of immigrants in particular are much more likely to rise the socioeconomic ranks than the children and grandchildren of similarly situated non-immigrants. And that actually, immigrants from all of those countries, from El Salvador and from Vietnam and from Kenya, are rising through the socioeconomic ranks at about the same speed as Italian and Irish immigrants did a century ago.
And Italian and Irish immigrants of a century ago were accused of the same things that today's immigrants are being accused of as well. American, and maybe that's why American politicians used to point with, maybe pride is not the right word, but they used to talk about us being a melting pot. Maybe they had to, because that's the only way they could get around all these strangers coming in from other places. They also referred to us as a salad bowl. You don't like either term. You have a whole different point of view on this. What is it?
Yeah, so the idea of a melting pot emphasizes in a nice way that we are building a shared culture together, which will bear the mark of all of those different influences. But I think it tends to assume that we have to become too homogeneous in the end, that after we've all melted into this pot, we'll be indistinguishable. And that's not a realistic or an attractive vision of the future of America. I think one of the great things about America is its many different communities and the fact that they remain somewhat distinctive. The salad bowl goes too far in the other extreme. So the salad bowl starts to say, look, we'll just sort of live next to each other and somehow overall the country will be beautiful, but really each group will be completely separate. And all of your belonging, all of your identity as an American is not going to be to the country as a whole. You're not going to have many connections to people who are unlike you. It's really just to your ethnic, cultural, religious group. And I think that gives up on commonality too much. Mm. So the metaphor that I suggest in the book is that of a public park. So after having this great conversation, you and I might can go and hang out in a park and we can say, we really want to keep talking about this topic. We don't want to talk to anybody else. We stay among ourselves. And that's one of the things we get to do in a park. Mm-hmm. But also we might start to chat with some listeners and start to chat with some random people who are sitting around and make new connections, make new friendships. And that too has to be possible. And I think when you're trying to judge what a public park is like, a more appealing park is one where at least some people choose to engage in that kind of encounter. And that's the same for our society. It's perfectly fine for everybody to decide to remain a member of their cultural, ethnic, perhaps even racial group if what's important to them is to stay within the kind of group they grew up in. That's perfectly fine. You're allowed to do that. Nothing wrong with that. But if nobody builds this connective tissue, if nobody ventures outside of a group, if we don't have a shared identity above those groups as well, then that's going to make it much, much harder for our diverse democracies to succeed. And that's why we should encourage those kinds of connections.
Americans, discontented or not, are facing a lot of challenges right now. Economic challenges that come from many different quarters. We have the globalization, which is bringing in cheaper, lower-priced goods on the one hand, but also outsourcing jobs on the other. We have people who are afraid of the immigration that we're experiencing in this country. And now we're enduring this clash of ideologies in the United States. In another of your articles in The Atlantic, you write about another thing that is leading to dissatisfaction among Americans, and that is the fact that our government does not represent our desires. In short, you say, quote, if it did, the country would look radically different. Marijuana would be legal and campaign contributions more tightly regulated. Paid parental leave would be the law, and public colleges would be free. The minimum wage would be higher and gun control stricter, and abortions would be more accessible. The opposite is happening, and people are working hard in this country to move it even more away from the direction that you just talked about if we did what the people wanted. Isn't that a recipe for disaster?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the important things in a political system is that it actually responds to the views of the majority of people. You know, that is the basic promise of democracy, that the people rule. We need institutions that give people the confidence that those preferences will actually ultimately be respected. And certainly one of the dangers of political systems where that's not the case is that people will eventually say, well, look, you know, if we can't get done what we think is important through these democratic mechanisms, then perhaps we should resort to non-democratic mechanisms, and perhaps we should resort to strongman leaders who are going to try and bypass those institutions in order to get those things done. But, you know, it's interesting because since I've written this article, I feel like a lot of my friends have become a lot less confident that they can convince the average voter. You know, there used to be this idea that among, you know, people who are left of center, who are liberal, who are on the left, that most people are on our side and we need to appeal to them. And that's the way we win elections. I think actually now there's a little bit of a fashion of saying, you know, there's something wrong with the average citizen. And the average citizen is dangerous. The average citizen is bigoted. And so we actually can't rely on them. I feel that in the air. I feel that honestly when I listen to NPR sometimes. And I think that's really dangerous because you can't be a small D Democrat. You can't truly believe in democracy if you don't think that the majority of your fellow citizens are capable most of the time of getting things right. That doesn't mean that people, you know, vote for the right political party or for the right cause at every election. It doesn't mean that on important issues, the majority of the people can't be wrong some of the time. But you have to have a bottom level trust in the moral judgment and the wisdom of your fellow citizens. And when you really lose that, you actually start to set yourself up against democracy. And I worry that some of my own friends and some of my own acquaintances, some of my colleagues in political science have given up on democracy in that kind of way.
And is that coming from both sides of the political divide, both Republicans and Democrats, or is it coming from one side more than the other, this feeling that the citizens don't know what's good for them?
I think it comes from different sides of the political spectrum in slightly different ways. So I think on the right, it is this distinction between real Americans or real citizens and those who aren't, which is really pernicious because it's deeply exclusionary. In part on ideological grounds, but also often on ethnic and cultural grounds. So, you know, that is this set of exclusionary attitudes that's driven by this demographic doom-mongering, and that's, you know, that can lead to terrible attempts at excluding people from the polls and so on. I think on the left, which is sort of what's most familiar to me, it takes a slightly different form. It takes a form of thinking that it's our job to be enlightened and to sort of educate everybody else. It's our job, you know, we've figured out what the truth is and we've figured out what's right. And if people disagree with us, then it's not that perhaps we've realized that some of our ideas aren't exactly right, or being a little bit simplistic, that we don't understand the concerns of people who have less privileged lives than us, frankly. It's that they're backward and bigoted, and we have to redouble our efforts at telling them what they should think and how they should live. So I think that the form it takes on the two sides of the political spectrum is a little different.
So before we run out of time, I want to talk a little bit about the four foundational yet highly contested questions you say that every democracy needs to ask in order to thrive. And one is what role the state should play in democracies. And that role, you say, is to protect its citizens from persecution by the state or an intolerant majority. But you have people in Congress like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and Madison Cawthorn and others who say we're already suffering from that persecution and they are out to free us from it. Who owns the question?
Well, I think I think the less time we spend thinking about Marjorie Taylor Greene, the better. But the fundamental question is a really important philosophical question, which is, you know, in a country like the United States, we have individual citizens, we have groups to which people give great importance, and then we have the national level, the state. And the question is, what power should be at each of those levels? How do we regulate the interaction of those different kinds of things? And the answer I give is that we can help to keep the peace in these deeply diverse democracies. We can help our societies thrive together if we give people a double freedom. So the first is the obvious and traditional one, which is that you got to be able to be in a minority in the United States and be safe from the government. You got to be able to criticize the president without fearing that you might go to jail. You got to be able to engage in a form of religious worship that the majority of citizens might find to be wrongheaded or offensive, and not have to worry that some mob is going to come and beat you up. So you have to be protected against the tyranny of a majority. There's a kind of second kind of freedom, which is also very important historically. And that's that actually most of the time people have been constrained not by the state or the tyranny of a majority, but by what Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson call the cage of norms, which is to say by the things that your parents tell you to do, your aunties and uncles tell you to do, your neighbors, your priest or your mom or your rabbi. And you also have to be able to free yourself from that cage of norms. So a second fundamental freedom is that if you want to leave your group, you want to strike out on your own, if you want to live very differently from your ancestors, that too has to be possible. And the best philosophical tradition for explaining how both of those things can be possible at the same time is philosophical liberalism. It's the idea that we have rights and duties as individual citizens. Part of those rights is to belong to groups. And so when we respect groups, it is because the members have freely chosen to be part of them. But that also means that we have a right and a duty to intervene when groups within our societies start to oppress the members.
I'm sorry, I have about 30 seconds left. And you talk about if we want to succeed, we need an inclusive patriotism. And in fact, we need to redefine patriotism. What would that look like?
Well, we're seeing in Ukraine right now that patriotism can be a force for good, that it can inspire millions of people to risk their lives to fight for a big cause. But patriotism obviously cannot take an ethnic form. It cannot be based around who your ancestors were. It has to have an important civic element. It has to be based in pride of a constitution and the political principles we share. But I think it should also be based in an inclusive, everyday cultural patriotism. In our, you know, when most people say they love America, they say they love its countries and its countryside, its sights and sounds and smells, the kind of way we interact with each other, its TikTok stars and its celebrities. And that's an inclusive, dynamic, diverse culture, which I think we should celebrate and be proud of.
And I should mention that despite all the things that we've talked about and where we seem to be headed, you are optimistic that we can maintain this democracy. Yasha Monk, his book is called The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.